גבירותיי, רבותיי, מאז שנת תשתדווה מתייחדים אנשי האוניברסיטה העברית עם זכרו של דוקטר יהודה לייב מגנס, זיכרונו לברכה, בסדרות ההרצאות הנערכות לזכרו בכל סתיו. שנה-שנה מרצה, מורה האוניברסיטה, או איש מדע, אורח מחוץ לארץ, על אחד הנושאים שהיו קרובים לליבו של המנוח, וההרצאות מתפרסמות בצורת ספרים או חוברות. הפעם נפתחת סדרת ההרצאות בחג האורים, בשנת ה-30 לפתיחתו של המכון למדעי היהדות, שדוקטר מגנס היה מחולליו ומייסדו. בזה גיירה את אבן הפינה לבניין המפואר, האוניברסיטה העברית, שנפתח באופן רשמי לאחר מכן באביב תשתדווה. בהתייחדנו היום עם זכרו של דוקטר מגנס, מעלים אנו על נס את הדמות האצילה הזאת, שיות מפוארת, מופלאה, איש הרוח והמס, הוגה דעות ואיש החזון, ובאותו הזמן יוצר ערכים בני קיימא. הוא היה רב פועלים בשטחים רבים, בתפוצות ובישראל. בגולת הכותרת של מפעל חייו, האוניברסיטה העברית. זכרו של דוקטר מגנס לא תמוש מלב הממשיכים במפעל חייו. לסדרת הרצאות של השנה הזאת הוזמן הפרופסור לאו שטראוס, פרופסור באוניברסיטה של שיקגו, שקיבל אותנו לביקור ממושך בירושלים כפרופסור אורח באוניברסיטה העברית. אני שמח גם בהזדמנות זו לברכו בברכה לבבית, ברכת ברוך הבא אלינו. כבר בזמן הקצר ששולטו כאן, ישרה מרוחו על המורים והתלמידים. אנחנו שמחים כולנו שהפרופסור שטראוס הסכים להרצות את סדרת הרצאות על הנושא פילוסופיה מדינית מהי. הנושא של ההרצאה הראשונה הערב תהיה הבעיה של הפילוסופיה המדינית. וההרצאה הבאה תהיה בשבוע הבא, ביום החמישי, כאן בעולם זה ובאותו הזמן. הפרופסור שטראוס.
President Nassar, faculty and students of the Hebrew University, ladies and gentlemen. It is a great honor, and at the same time... I think so. Palmer Recherche, Alfred. It's a great honor and at the same time a task of extraordinary difficulty to speak about political philosophy at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. In this city and in this land, the theme of political philosophy, justice and the just city, has been taken more seriously than anywhere else on earth. Nowhere else has the longing for justice and the just city filled the purest hearts and the loftiest souls with such zeal as on this sacred soil. I know all too well that I'm utterly incompetent to convey to you what in the best possible case, in the case of any man, would be no more than a faint reproduction or a weak imitation of our prophet's vision. I shall even be compelled to lead you into a region where the dimmest recollection of that vision is on the point of vanishing altogether, where the kingdom of God is derisively called an imagined principality, to say here nothing of the region which was never illumined by that vision. But while being compelled, or compelling myself, to wander far away from our sacred heritage, and to be silent about it, I shall not for a moment cease to think of it. The meaning of political philosophy and its meaningful character is as evident today as it always has been since the time when political philosophy came to light in Athens. All political action aims at either preservation or change. When desiring to preserve, we wish to prevent a change for the worse. When desiring to change, we wish to bring about something better. All political action is then guided by some thought of better and worse. But thought of better and worse implies thought of the good. The awareness of the good, which guides all our action, has the character of opinion. It is no longer questioned, but on reflection, it proves to be questionable. This very fact that we can question it directs us towards such a thought of the good as is no longer questionable, toward a thought which is no longer opinion, but knowledge. All political action has then in itself a directedness toward knowledge of the good life, or of the good society. If this directedness becomes explicit, if men make it their explicit goal to acquire knowledge of the good life and of the good society, political philosophy emerges. By calling this pursuit political philosophy, we imply that it forms a part of a larger whole of philosophy, or that political philosophy is a branch of philosophy. In the expression political philosophy, philosophy indicates a manner of treatment, a treatment which is both radical, that's to say, going to the roots, and comprehensive. Political indicates both the subject matter and the function. Political philosophy deals with political matters in a manner that is meant to be relevant for political life. Therefore, its subject must be identical with the goal, the ultimate goal of political action. The theme of political philosophy, mankind's great objectives, freedom and government or empire, are objectives which are capable to lift all men beyond their poor selves. Political philosophy is that branch of philosophy which is closest to political life, to non-philosophic life, to human life. Only in his politics does Aristotle make use of oaths, the almost inevitable accompaniment of passionate speech. Since political philosophy is a branch of philosophy, even the most provisional clarification of what political philosophy is cannot dispense with a clarification, however provisional, of what philosophy is. Philosophy, as quest for wisdom, is quest for universal knowledge, for knowledge of the whole. The quest would not be necessary if such knowledge were immediately available. The absence of knowledge of the whole does not mean, however, that men do not have thoughts about the whole. Philosophy is necessarily preceded by opinions about the whole. It is therefore an attempt to replace opinions about the whole by knowledge of the whole. Instead of the whole, the philosophers also say all things. The whole is not a pure ether or an unrelieved darkness in which one cannot distinguish one part from the other, or in which one cannot discern anything. Quest for knowledge of all things means quest for knowledge of God, the world, and man, or rather, quest for knowledge of the natures of all things, the natures in their totality. This is what is meant by the whole. Philosophy is essentially not possession of the truth, but quest for the truth. The distinctive trait of the philosopher is that he knows nothing, and that his insight into our ignorance regarding the most important things induces him to strive with all his power for knowledge. He would cease to be a philosopher by evading the questions concerning these things, or by disregarding them because they cannot be answered. It may be that as regards the possible answers to these questions, the pros and cons will always be in a more or less even balance, and that therefore philosophy will never go beyond the stage of discussion or disputation, and will never reach the stage of decision. This would not make philosophy futile, for the clear grasp of a fundamental question requires understanding of the nature of the subject matter with which the question is concerned. Genuine knowledge of a fundamental question, thorough understanding of it, is better than blindness to it or indifference to it, be that indifference or blindness accompanied by knowledge of the answers to a vast number of peripheral and ephemeral questions or not. To quote, the least which can be obtained of the knowledge of the highest things is more desirable than the most certain knowledge which can be obtained of the smallest things, unquote. Of philosophy thus understood, political philosophy is a branch. Political philosophy will then be the attempt to replace opinion about the nature of political things by knowledge of the nature of political things. Political things are by nature subject to approval and disapproval, to choice and rejection, to praise and blame. It is of their essence not to be neutral, but to raise a claim to man's obedience, allegiance, decision, or judgment. One does not understand them as what they are, as political things, if one does not take seriously the explicit or implicit claim to be judged in terms of goodness or badness, of justice or injustice, that is to say, if one does not measure them by some standard of goodness or justice. To judge soundly, one would have to know the true standards. If political philosophy wishes to do justice to its subject matter, it must strive for these standards. Political philosophy is the attempt truly to know both the nature of political things and the right or the just or good political order. Political philosophy is political philosophy. Political thought is as such indifferent to the distinction between opinion and knowledge. But political philosophy is a conscious, coherent, and relentless effort to replace opinion about the political fundamentals by knowledge regarding them. Political thought may not be more, and may not even intend to be more, than the expounding or the defense of a firmly held conviction or of an invigorating myth. But it is essential to political philosophy to be set in motion and to be kept in motion by the disquieting awareness of the fundamental difference between conviction or belief and knowledge. A political thinker who is not a philosopher is primarily interested in or attached to a specific order or policy. A political philosopher is primarily interested in or attached to the truth. Political thought, which is not political philosophy, finds its adequate expression in laws and codes, in poems and stories, and tracts and public speeches, among others. The proper form of presenting political philosophy, treatise. Political thought is as old as the human race. The first man who uttered a word like father or an expression like thou shalt not was the first political thinker. But political philosophy appeared at a knowable time in the recorded past. By political theory, people understand today frequently comprehensive reflections on the political situation which lead up to the suggestion of a broad policy. Such reflections appeal in the last resort to principles accepted by public opinion or a considerable part of public opinion. That's to say, they dogmatically assume principles which can well be questioned. Works of political theory in this sense would be Pinsker's Autoemancipation and Herzl's Judenstaat. Pinsker's Autoemancipation carries as its motto the words Im ena nili, emili, wie im loach schav, imatai. It omits the words Urja anile atzmi, ma ani. Pinsker's silent rejection of the thought expressed in the omitted words is a crucial premise of the argument developed in his tract. Pinsker does not justify rejection. For a justification, one would have to turn to the third chapter of Spinoza's theological-political treatise, to the work of a political philosopher. We are compelled to distinguish political philosophy also from political theology. By political theology, we understand political teachings which are based on divine revelation. Political philosophy is limited to what is accessible to the unassisted human mind. As regards social philosophy, it has the same subject matter as political philosophy. Only the point of view is different. Political philosophy rests on the premise that the political association is the most authoritative or the most comprehensive human association, whereas social philosophy conceives of the political association as a part of a larger whole, which it designates by the term society. Finally, we must try to define the relation of political philosophy to political science. Political science is an ambiguous term. It designates such investigations of political things as are guided by the model of natural science, and it designates the work which is being done by the members of political science departments. As regards the former, or what we may call scientific political science, it conceives of itself as the way towards genuine knowledge of political things. Just as genuine knowledge of natural things began when people turned from sterile and vain speculation to empirical and experiential study, the genuine knowledge of political things will begin when political philosophy will have given way completely to the scientific study of politics. Just as natural science stands on its own feet and at most supplies unintentionally materials for the speculations of natural philosophers, political science stands on its own feet and at most supplies unintentionally materials for the speculations of political philosophers. Considering the contrast between the solidity of the one pursuit and the pitiful pretentiousness characteristic of the other, it is, however, more reasonable to dismiss the vague and inane speculations of political philosophy altogether than to go on paying lip service to a wholly discredited and decrepit tradition. The sciences, both natural and political, are frankly non-philosophic. They need philosophy of a kind, methodology or logic. But these philosophic disciplines have obviously nothing in common with political philosophy. Scientific political science is in fact incompatible with political philosophy. The useful work done by the men called political scientists is the independent of any aspiration towards scientific political science. It consists of careful and judicious collections and analyses of politically relevant data. To understand the meaning of this work, we remind ourselves of our provisional definition of political philosophy. Political philosophy is an attempt to understand the nature of political things. Before one can even think of attempting to understand the nature of political things, one must know political things. One must possess political knowledge. At least every sane adult possesses political knowledge to some degree. Everyone knows something of taxes, police, jails, law, war, peace, armistice. Everyone knows that the aim of war is victory, that war demands a supreme sacrifice and many other deprivations, that bravery deserves praise and cowardice deserves blame. Everyone knows that buying a shirt, as distinguished from casting a vote, is not in itself a political action. The man in the street is supposed to possess less political knowledge than the men who make it their business to supply him with information and guidance regarding political matters. He certainly possesses less political knowledge than very intelligent men of long and varied political experience. At the top of the ladder, we find the great statesman who possesses political knowledge, political understanding, political wisdom, political skill in the highest degree. In a word, political science, politike episteme, in the original meaning of the term. All political knowledge, on whatever level, is surrounded by political opinion and interspersed with it. By political opinion, we understand here opinion as distinguished from knowledge of political things. Errors, guesses, beliefs, prejudices, forecasts, and so on. It is of the essence of political life to be guided by a mixture of political knowledge and political opinion. Hence, all political life is accompanied by more or less coherent and more or less strenuous efforts to replace political opinion by political knowledge. Even governments which lay claim to more than human knowledge are known to employ spies. The character of political knowledge and of the demands made on it has been profoundly affected by a fairly recent change in the character of society. In former times, intelligent men could acquire all political knowledge, all political understanding they needed by listening to wise old men, or, which is the same thing, by reading good historians, as well as looking around and devoting themselves to public affairs. These ways of acquiring political knowledge are no longer sufficient because we live in what is called dynamic mass societies. That's to say, in societies which are characterized by both immense complexity and rapid change. Political knowledge is more difficult to come by, and it becomes obsolete more rapidly than in former times. Under these conditions, it becomes necessary that a number of men should devote themselves entirely to the task of collecting and digesting knowledge of political things. It is this activity which today is frequently called political science. It does not emerge if it has not been realized, among other things, that even such political matters as have no bearing on the situation of the day deserve to be studied, and that their study must be carried on with the greatest possible care, a specific care which is designated to counteract the specific fallacies to which our judgment on political things is exposed. Furthermore, the men we speak of invest much toil in giving political knowledge the form of teachings which can be transmitted in classrooms. Moreover, while even the most unscrupulous politician must constantly try to replace in his own mind political opinion by political knowledge in order to be successful, the scholarly student of political things will go beyond this by trying to state the results of his investigations in public without any concealment and without any partisanship. He will act the part of the enlightened and patriotic citizen who has no axe of his own to grind. Or differently expressed, the scholarly quest for political knowledge is essentially animated by a moral impulse, the love of truth. But however one may conceive of the difference between the scholarly and the non-scholarly quest for political knowledge, and however important these differences may be, the scholarly and the non-scholarly quest for political knowledge are identical in the decisive respect. Their center of reference is a given political situation, and even in most cases, the given political situation in the individual's own country. It is true that a botanist in Israel pays special attention to the flora of Israel, whereas a botanist in Canada pays special attention to the flora of Canada. But this difference, which is not more than the outcome of a convenient and even indispensable division of labor, has an entirely different character than the only apparently similar difference between the preoccupation of an Israeli scientist and a Canadian political scientist. It is only when the here and now ceases to be the center of reference that a philosophic or scientific approach to politics can emerge. All knowledge of political things implies assumptions concerning the nature of political things. That's to say, assumptions which concern not merely the given political situation, but political life or human life as such. One cannot know anything about a war going on at a given time without having some notion, however dim and hazy, of war as such and its place within human life as such. One cannot see a policeman as a policeman without having made an assumption about law and government as such. The assumptions concerning the nature of political things, which are implied in all knowledge of political things, have the character of opinions. It is only when these assumptions are made the theme of critical and coherent analysis that a philosophic or scientific approach to politics emerges in fact. The cognitive status of political knowledge is not different from that of the knowledge possessed by the shepherd, the husband, the general, or the cook. Yet the pursuits of these types of men do not give rise to a pastoral, matrimonial, military, or culinary philosophy, because their ultimate goals are sufficiently clear and unambiguous. The ultimate political goal, on the other hand, urgently calls for coherent reflection. The goal of the general is victory, whereas the goal of the statesman is a common good. Political philosophy, as we have tried to circumscribe it, has been cultivated since its beginning almost without any interruption until a relatively short time ago. Today, political philosophy is in a state of decay and perhaps of putrefaction, if it has not vanished altogether. Not only is there complete disagreement regarding its subject matter, its methods, and its function, its very possibility in any form has become questionable. The only agreement left among academic teachers of political science concerns the usefulness of studying the history of political philosophy. As regards the philosophers, it is sufficient to contrast the work of the four greatest philosophers of the last 40 years, Bergson, Whitehead, Husserl, and Heidegger, with the work of Hermann Cohen, in order to see how rapidly and how thoroughly political philosophy has become discredited. We may describe the present situation as follows. Originally, political philosophy was identical with political science, and it was the all-embracing study of human affairs. Today, we find it cut into pieces, which behave as if they were parts of a whole. In the first place, one has applied the distinction between philosophy and science to the study of human affairs, and accordingly one makes a distinction between a non-philosophic political science and a non-scientific political philosophy, a distinction which, under present conditions, takes away all dignity, all honesty from political philosophy. Furthermore, large segments of what formerly belonged to political philosophy or political science have become emancipated under the names of economics, sociology, and social psychology. The pitiable rump for which honest social scientists do not care is left as prey to philosophers of history and to people who amuse themselves more than others with professions of faith. We hardly exaggerate when we say that today political philosophy does not exist anymore, except as matter for burial, let's say for historical research, or else as a theme of weak and unconvincing protestations. If we inquire into the reasons for this great change, we receive these answers. Political philosophy is unscientific, or it is unhistorical, or it is both science and history. These two great powers of the modern world have eventually succeeded in destroying the very possibility of political philosophy. The rejection of political philosophy as unscientific is characteristic of present-day positivism. Positivism is no longer what it desired to be when Auguste Comte originated it. It still agrees with Comte by maintaining that modern science is the highest form of human knowledge. But after having been modified by utilitarianism, evolutionism, and neo-Kantianism, it has abandoned completely Kant's hope that a social science modeled on modern natural science would be able to overcome the intellectual anarchy of modern society. In about the last decade of the 19th century, social science positivism reached its final form by realizing or decreeing that there is a fundamental difference between facts and values, and that only factual judgments are within the competence of science. Scientific social science is incompetent to pronounce value judgments and must avoid value judgments altogether. As for the meaning of the term value in statements of this kind, we can hardly say more than that values mean both things preferred and the principles of preference. A discussion of the tenets of social science positivism is today indispensable for clarifying the meaning of political philosophy. We consider first the practical consequences of this positivism. Positivistic social science is value-free or ethically neutral. It is neutral in the conflict between good and evil, however good and evil may be understood. This means that the ground which is common to all social scientists, the ground on which they carry on their investigations and discussions, can only be reached through a process of emancipation from moral judgment or of abstracting from moral judgment. Moral obtuseness is the ideal condition for scientific analysis. For to the extent to which we are not yet completely insensitive to moral distinctions, we are forced to make value judgments. The habit of looking at social or human phenomena without making value judgments has a corroding influence on any preferences. The more serious we are as social scientists, the more completely we develop within ourselves a state of indifference to any goal, a state of aimlessness and drifting, a state which may well be called nihilism. The social scientist is not immune to preferences. His activity is a constant fight against the preferences he has as a human being and as a citizen, and which threaten to overcome his scientific detachment. He derives the power to counteract these dangerous influences by his dedication to one and only one value, to truth. But according to his principles, truth is not a value which it is necessary to choose. One may reject it as well as choose it. The scientist as scientist must indeed have chosen it, but neither scientists nor science are simply necessary. Social science cannot pronounce then on the question of whether social science itself is good. It is compelled to teach that society can with equal right and with equal reason favor social science as well as suppress it as disturbing, subversive, corrosive, nihilistic. But strangely enough, we find social scientists very anxious to sell social science, if I may use this common American term, that is to say, to prove that social science is necessary. They will argue as follows. Regardless of what our preferences or ends may be, we wish to achieve our ends. To achieve our ends, we must know which means are conducive to our ends. But adequate knowledge of the means conducive to any social ends is the sole function of social science and only of social science. Hence, social science is necessary for any society or any social movement. Social science is then simply necessary. It is a value from every point of view. But once we grant this, we are seriously tempted to wonder whether there are not a few other things which must be values from every point of view or for every thinking human being. To avoid this inconvenience, the social scientists will scorn all considerations of public relations or of private advancement, and take refuge in the virtuous contention that he doesn't know, but merely believes, that quest for truth is good. Other men may believe with equal right that quest for truth is bad. But what does he mean by this contention? Either he makes a distinction between noble and ignoble objectives, or he refuses to make such a distinction. If he makes a distinction between noble and ignoble objectives, he will say that there is a variety of noble objectives or of ideals, and that there is no ideal which is compatible with all other ideals. If one chooses truth as one's ideal, one necessarily rejects other ideals. This being the case, there cannot be a necessity, an evident necessity, for self-respecting men to choose truth in preference to other ideals. But as long as a social scientist speaks of ideals and thus makes a distinction between noble and not noble objectives, or between idealistic integrity and petty egoism, he makes a value judgment which, according to his fundamental contention, is as such no longer necessary. He must then say that it is as legitimate to make the pursuit of safety, income, prestige, one's sole aim in life, as it is to make the quest for truth one's chief aim. He thus lays himself open to the suspicion that his activity as a social scientist serves no other purpose than to increase his safety, his income, and his prestige, or that his competence as a social scientist is a skill which he is prepared to sell to the highest bidder. Honest citizens will begin to wonder whether such a man can be trusted or whether he can be loyal. In a word, he will get entangled in the predicament which leads to the downfall of Thrasymachus and his taming by Socrates in the first book of Plato's Republic. It goes without saying that while our social scientist may be confused, he is very far from being disloyal and from lacking in integrity. His assertion that integrity and quest for truth, which are values which one can with equal right choose or reject, is a mere movement of his lips and his tongue, to which nothing corresponds in his heart or mind. I have never met any scientific social scientist who, apart from being dedicated to truth and integrity, was not also wholeheartedly devoted to democracy. When he says that democracy is a value which is not evidently superior to the opposite value, he does not mean that he is impressed by the alternative which he rejects, or that his heart or his mind are torn between alternatives which in themselves are equally attractive. His ethical neutrality is so far from being nihilism or a road to nihilism that it is not more than an excellent alibi for thoughtlessness and vulgarity. By saying that democracy and truth are values, he says in effect that one doesn't have to think about the reasons why these things are good, and that he may bow as well as anyone else to the values adopted and respected by his society. Social science positivism fosters not nihilism, but conformism and philistinism. It is not possible to enter here and now into a discussion of the theoretical weaknesses of social science positivism. I can hardly allude to the chief considerations which, to my mind, speak decisively against this approach. In the first place, it is impossible, it seems to me, to study social phenomena, that is to say, all important social phenomena, without making value judgments. A man who calls himself a political historian and refuses to distinguish between great statesmen, mediocrities, and insane imposters may be a good bibliographer. He cannot say anything relevant about political history. A man who calls himself a sociologist of religion and cannot distinguish between a profound religious thinker and a languishing superstition, may be a good statistician. He cannot say anything relevant about the relations of religion and society. Generally speaking, it is impossible to understand the human thought or action or work without evaluating it. If we are unable to evaluate it as yet, as we very frequently are, we have not yet succeeded in understanding it, not by greater clarity or certainty, but merely by their poverty. The operator is as well adjusted as, he may be better adjusted than, a good man and a good citizen. Finally, we must not overlook the invisible value judgments which are concealed from undiscerning eyes, but nevertheless most effective in allegedly purely descriptive concepts. For example, when social scientists distinguish between democratic and authoritarian habits or types of human beings, what they call authoritarian is in all cases known to me a caricature of everything of which they, as good democrats of a certain kind, disapprove. Or when they speak of the three principles of legitimacy, rational, traditional, and charismatic, their very expression, routinization of charisma, betrays a Protestant and or liberal preference. No conservative Jew and no Catholic would accept the inevitable consequence of the application of this notion of routinization of charisma to the genesis of the halakha out of biblical prophecy, on the one hand, and to the genesis of the ecclesiastical hierarchy out of the New Testament teaching on the other. The second point to which I would refer is this. It has never been proven. It has merely been asserted that conflicts between different values are essentially insoluble for human reason. There are conflicts which cannot in fact be settled by human reason. But if we cannot decide which of two mountains whose peaks are hidden by clouds is higher than the other, cannot we decide that a mountain is higher than a molehill? If we cannot decide regarding a war between two neighboring nations, which have been fighting each other for centuries, whose nation's cause is more just, can't we decide that Jezebel's action against Naboth was unqualifiedly unjust? The greatest representative of social science positivism, Max Weber, has postulated the insolubility of all value conflicts because, being the haunted son of a haunted nation, his soul craved a universe in which failure, that bastard of sin, instead of felicity and serenity, was to be the mark of human nobility. The allegedly theoretical or methodological assertion that value conflicts are insoluble for human reason was, in the most important case, in the only important case, a postulate dictated by a morbid moral taste. Thirdly, I would say it is not true that scientific knowledge is the only solid knowledge which men possess. This superstition fosters all sorts of sterile investigations and complicated idiocies. Things which every 10-year-old child knows are regarded as being in need of scientific proof in order to become acceptable as facts. And this scientific proof, which is not only not necessary, is not even possible. To take the simplest example, all studies in social science presuppose that its devotees can tell human beings from other beings. This knowledge was not acquired in classrooms, and this knowledge is not transformed by social science into scientific knowledge, but retains its initial status without any modification throughout. If this pre-scientific knowledge is not knowledge, all scientific studies which stand or fall with it lack the character of knowledge. The preoccupation with scientific proof of things which everyone knows well enough and better without scientific proof leads to the neglect of that thinking or that reflection which must precede all scientific studies if these studies are to be relevant. To give again only the most simple example, political science requires clarification of what distinguishes political things from things which are not political. It requires, therefore, that the question be raised and answered, what is political? This question cannot be dealt with scientifically, but only, to use the old term, dialectically. As regards fundamental questions of this kind, our friends of scientific exactness are strangely unexacting. And finally, positivism necessarily transforms itself into historicism. By virtue of its orientation by the model of the natural sciences, social science is in danger of mistaking peculiarities, say, of mid-20th century United States, or more generally, modern Western society, for essential characters of human society. To avoid this danger, it is compelled to engage in what is called cross-cultural research, that is to say, in the study of other cultures, both present and past. But here it is constantly tempted to force these other cultures into the Procrustean bed of modern Western categories. It becomes therefore necessary for the social scientist to take a critical distance from these categories. He is compelled eventually to view his own science, modern Western science, as one way of thinking among many. In other words, positivistic science is forced to give a scientific account of science itself, that is to say, a genetic account. As a consequence, modern science proves to be one historically conditioned interpretation of the world, which in the last analysis is not superior to other possible interpretations of the world. Modern science appears henceforth no longer as the perfection of man's natural understanding, but as one possible modification of man's natural understanding. It is only at this point that we come face to face with a serious enemy of political philosophy, and that is historicism. Historicism is distinguished from positivism by the following characteristics. It abandons the distinction between facts and values because every understanding, however theoretical, implies specific evaluations. It denies the authoritative character of modern science, which appears only as one form among many of man's thinking orientation in the world. It refuses to regard the historical process as fundamentally progressive, or more generally stated, as reasonable. And finally, it denies the relevance of the evolutionist thesis by contending that the evolution of man out of non-man cannot make intelligible man's character, man's humanity. Far from being subhuman, the beginning of man is rather more than human. It is the deepest mystery. Historicism rejects the question of the good society, that is to say, of the good society, because of the essentially historical character of society and of human thought. There is no essential necessity, it contends, for raising the question of the good society. This question is not in principle coeval with human thought, but its very possibility is the outcome of a mysterious dispensation of fate. The crucial issue concerns the status of those permanent characters of humanity, such as a distinction between the noble and the base, which must be admitted and which are admitted by the intelligent historicists. Can these permanencies be used as criteria for distinguishing between good and bad dispensations of fate? The historicist answers this question in the negative. The attitude which was taken by the greatest and most radical historicists towards the events in Germany in 1933, namely his enthusiastic submission to this dispensation of fate, indicates the gravity of the issue and, to my mind at least, the fundamental weakness of historicists. 1933 would rather seem to have proved, if such proof had been necessary, that man cannot abandon the question of the good society and that he cannot free himself from the responsibility for answering it by deferring to history or to any other power different from his own reason.
ישיבתנו, יש לי שיער טוב שמזק האוויר בוודאי השפיע לרעה על המספר של המבקרים. אני אמרתי ברגע זה שיש להתפלא שבאו כל כך רבים במזק אוויר כזה. פרופסור שטראוס דיבר הפעם האחרונה על הבעיה של הפילוסופיה המדינית, והיום הוא ידבר על הפתרון הקלאסי.
Ladies and gentlemen, when we call the political philosophy of Plato and of Aristotle classical political philosophy, we imply that it is the classic form of political philosophy. The classic was once said to be characterized by noble simplicity and quiet grandeur. This suggestion guides us into the right direction. It is an attempt to articulate what was formerly also called the natural character of classical thought. Natural is here understood in contradistinction to what is merely human, all too human. A human being is said to be natural if he is guided by nature rather than by convention or by inherited opinion or by tradition. Classical political philosophy is non-traditional in this sense because it belongs to the fertile moment when all political traditions were shaken and there was not yet in existence a tradition of political philosophy. In all later epochs, the philosopher's study of political things was mediated by a tradition of political philosophy, which acted like a screen between the philosopher and political things, regardless of whether the individual philosopher cherished or rejected that tradition. From this it follows that the classical philosophers see the political things with a freshness and directness which has never been equaled. They look at the political things in the perspective of the enlightened citizen or statesman. They see things clearly which the enlightened citizen or statesman does not see clearly or does not see at all. But this is due merely to the fact that they look further afield in the same direction as the enlightened citizen or statesman. They do not look at political things from the outside as spectators of political life. They speak the language of the citizen or statesman. They hardly use a single term which is not familiar on the marketplace. Hence, their political philosophy is comprehensive. It is both political theory and political skill. It is open-minded to the legal and institutional aspects of political life, as it is to that which transcends the legal and the institutional. It is equally free from the narrowness of the lawyer, the brutality of the technician, the the vagaries of the visionary and the baseness of the opportunist. It reproduces and raises to its perfection the magnanimous flexibility of the great statesman. It is free from all fanaticism because it knows that evil cannot be eradicated, and therefore that one's expectation from politics must be moderate. The spirit which animates it may be described as serenity or sublime sobriety. Compared with classical political philosophy or later political thought, whatever else its merits may be, and in particular modern political thought, has a derivative character. This means that in later times there has occurred an estrangement from the simple and primary issues. This has given to political philosophy the character of abstractness and has therefore engendered the view that the philosophic movement must be a movement not from opinion to knowledge, not from the here and now to what is always or eternal, but from the abstract towards the concrete. It was thought that by virtue of this movement towards the concrete, recent philosophy has overcome the limitation, not only of modern...